So now we have James Wells, and he's going to tell about the third frontier, the cosmology and the LHC, of course.
Okay, it's a great pleasure for me to speak before you, a group of teachers, fine teachers in this country. I've been living in France for the last few years, and there's very good teachers there too, they tell me. And at CERN, it's different than here. At CERN, it's sort of a European center for particle physics and physics in general. It's a very high profile there. So they have teachers that are bussed in all the way from Poland and Britain and various places. And staff members give talks to teachers there. And so I've gotten a little bit of advice from them. And I promise I won't slip into Polish. I try not to, but I've gotten a little bit of advice, and I hope it helps. My discussion today is on cosmology connections with the LHC. And of course, it's an infinite topic. There's cosmology implications from the LHC in baryogenesis, which was alluded to in the last talk. This is the total number of baryons in the universe compared to anti-baryons. I won't talk about that. It's a very rich subject, and it involves some new physics ideas that are similar to the things that I'll talk about today. And so in the question time, if you would like to ask, I'd be happy to mention a few things about that. I won't talk much about dark energy and the dark matter, except for briefly, dark energy and the cosmological constant. The connection of that to the LHC is a little bit less direct, of course, so that's the reason for skipping that. Today, I will talk mostly about dark matter, and you will see as it develops what I mean by dark matter, what the community means by dark matter. Okay. Humans in the universe. Science has mostly been about our bodies over the many, many centuries. What are we made of, and how do we interact with things? In fact, it was mentioned in the last talk that even the new particles, these exotic things like top quarks and muons and so on, these are just copies of things that make up our bodies. And I think a thread in the history of recent science is that human-centered science is less and less the full story of our universe. And my first bout of existentialist angst came when I was in seventh grade. And I want to show you the next picture, I think it's the next picture, is what caused that existential bout, is this one. This is the sun, this is to scale, this is a photo from that, drawing from NASA. And this is the Earth, compared to the sun, it's just a tremendous thing. And of course, for centuries now, we've understood that sort of we're nothing compared to the universe. And even on the solar scale, this creates seventh graders hiding in their room and thinking, I'm going to get crushed by something. Any old little thing could come in there and just crush us. And this is a solar flare, you know, and it's a scary thing for a seventh grader. I think they should have parental consent forms before they show photos, pictures like that. But I learned to deal with it. And then, of course, it gets scarier because we have the galaxy is a group of all of our stars. The Andromeda galaxy is the closest one. It's about 2.5 million light years away. It's the largest object in our local cluster. So I'm gonna go to larger and larger sizes in the universe, and then I want to demonstrate later how that's related to the smallest objects in our universe and what can be probed at the LHC. And so the Andromeda galaxy is a galaxy that I read a book about when I was in eighth grade, a science fiction book about somebody going to Andromeda. So that's always been dear to my heart. This is a photo pieced together by multiple photos in the sky. And the local cluster is a sort of a coherent object of multiple galaxies and galaxy-like things, large Magellanic Cloud, small Magellanic Cloud. They're small, sort of unusual galaxies. And they create a little system on their own. with structure. So we have the solar system, we have the galaxy, and then we have this local group of things. And then we've got the Virgo supercluster. We're part of the Virgo supercluster. The Milky Way is down in here in the local group with Andromeda and so on. And then 38 million light years away, there's this group, and then there's a Virgo cluster out here. And in this large area is a supercluster of things that sort of interact coherently. And you see that there's a scaling behavior in the universe, smaller objects organizing, bigger objects organizing, and it's almost scale invariant in some sense. Now, how does this all come about? How it came about was in the early universe, this is our story, that there was the Big Bang, and then things cooled down, elements were formed, and then a structure was formed by the seeding of gravitational interactions around the universe. And this is a simulation made by this group at Harvard, simulation of clustering on this universe scale. This is a cluster that's sort of similar to the Virgo cluster. And it's a Newton X-ray image of a real galaxy cluster is superimposed on this, pure numerical calculation from a computer. And you can see that there's an understanding in the cosmology astrophysics community of how all this structure is coming together. And what's really important for our discussion is that the evolution depends on the relative composition of the universe. So precisely how this computer program was able to simulate the structure of the universe depended upon how much matter was there, baryons, protons, and so on, how much dark matter was there, which we will talk about some possible candidates of dark matter, things that don't look like particles that we know, and dark energy, or the cosmological constant. And this structure formation depends quite a bit on the relative compositions in the universe. Now, the equations that are listed here, the composition of the universe is oftentimes given as fraction of critical density of the universe. And I'll illustrate the critical density in a slide or two. The critical density is about 10 to the minus 29 grams per centimeter cubed. And that's the density at which the universe is flat. And of course, that's extraordinarily low density compared to what we're used to here on Earth. But the universe is a very dark, dreary place. So that's another existential angst number, that 10 to the minus 29 grams per centimeter cubed, and it will only get worse in time. So this omega is the relative fraction of some quantity, in this case, dark energy or cosmological constant, compared to the critical density of the universe. And by saying that it's a flat universe, which we will come to in a few moments, it means that all these omegas need to sum up to one. So there's some contribution due to dark energy, there's some contribution due to dark matter, some contribution due to normal matter or baryonic matter, usually with this sub B it's called, and the total amount of matter contributions, so particle contributions to the density of the universe, is the dark matter piece plus the baryon density of the universe. So this is how we talk about, the cosmologists and astrophysicists talk about the composition of the universe in these very broad brush methods. Now, the composition of course, our body is made of oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen, but for the universe, these broader categories will have to do. And in fact, they are all that's needed to make that simulation that I showed you a few slides ago. The baryonic matter, just to be sure that everybody's clear on this, is the stuff that stars and planets and people are made of, with hydrogen and helium and oxygen and all these things. This is the baryonic matter. The dark matter is stable stuff we are not made of. That's a rough definition. And you probably would fail your students if they gave that definition for dark matter, but it's the stable stuff we are not made of. That's about how much we know about it right now. But I will give some illustrations of ideas that we have of what really makes up the dark matter. And it's not, this is too strong of a word, nothing, but it's not too similar to the particles that we are used to. It's probably different. And dark energy, the vacuum energy of the density of the universe, there's really exotic ideas about dark energy of the universe, and it's a fancy name that's given to what most probably is a cosmological constant in Einstein's equation. So these are the normal equations of general relativity, where gravity is sort of on this side, and then the energy momentum tensor, which is sort of how all matter interacts together, is on the right-hand side of Einstein's equation, and they have to be in this self-consistent form. And then you add on this one extra term, which at lunchtime today, somebody reminded me Einstein said that was his biggest mistake by introducing it, and now it's one of the most interesting quantities in physics today, is to try to understand the value of that constant, cosmological constant. Now I'm going to talk briefly some of the stories that the astrophysicists give us on the composition of the universe. They've done a lot of studies over the last few decades, and one of the earliest things to look at was so-called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So in the early universe, everything was in equilibrium. It was hot. There was quarks and photons and electrons, and as things cooled, there were neutrons and protons. And it turns out that the equilibrium density of neutrons to protons is related by, the ratio is related by an exponential of the mass difference of the two. So there's a little bit of a mass difference between the neutrons and the protons, and therefore there are more protons than neutrons. And if you take into account the decay of the neutrons and some subtleties, you find out that when nuclear reactions begin, the ratio of neutrons to protons is about a 7. And this is somewhat sensitive to neutron lifetime estimates. Almost all neutrons go into helium-4. It's the most stable element in this group of elements being formed. So almost all of them go into helium. And the fraction, therefore, is if you just do a simple 2 times 1 seventh over 1 plus 1 seventh gives you 0.25. So this is the total number of helium that's produced. And the data is indicating about 0.25 for the abundance of protons of helium. And then there's the heavier elements, deuterium, helium, different elements like lithium. And there's a lot more subtlety involved in this calculation, and people spend their lives on it, they're experts on it. And they find that there is a self-consistent story of the total baryon number of the universe. The self-consistent story that is generated is that every single element abundance is consistent with a vertical line on this, with one single total baryon number of the universe, baryon fraction of the universe. And what they come up with is that the baryon fraction is small. It's about 4%. Actually, H is the Hubble constant, so there's some uncertainty about what that value is, but it's about 1/2. And omega B, therefore, is about 4% of the critical density of the universe. So it's a small fraction of the critical density of the universe. So this is our existentialist angst point number 3, is that we're almost nothing, even the stuff that makes up our bodies, is almost nothing compared to the total fraction of the universe's density. Now, cosmic microwave background radiation, this made a lot of news about 10 years ago. There is this background radiation in the universe that froze out many, many, many years ago. And that freeze out was shifted into the infrared today to be a background temperature bath of photons of about 2.7 Kelvin. But it's not absolutely uniform of 2.7 Kelvin. It is there's some uncertainty of a few times 10 to the minus 3 Kelvin in the fluctuations of that temperature. So these fluctuations then can be mapped on the sky. You can look very carefully on the sky of small temperature deviations, and they are measured by WMAP, And it was initially measured very well by the COBE experiment in the early 90s. And then about a few years back, they've been making increasingly good measurements by the WMAP satellite team of these small temperature variations in the universe. Now, the bright spots are a certain distance away. You can look at the sky and you can see a certain angular degree separation between the bright spots in the sky. And that is very important in understanding the geometry of the universe. So if we have a closed universe, that means that the topology of the universe is sort of like a sphere, and we're living on a sphere. Then if we look at those bright spots after lots of calculations, doing grinding through computer code and things, we find that the bright spots should sort of on average be about a degree and a half apart. If the universe is open, and if it's open, you see that the lines from two bright spots coming in to the observer, let's say that's the observer, they sort of go in like this, right? And so the angle that they subtend is sort of unnaturally small. When it's open, the angle, it comes in like that, so it's sort of unnaturally, so to speak, bigger angle. And so here it's 1.5 degrees separation. Here it's 0.5 degree separation of the bright spots in the sky. And if it's a flat universe with geometry that's completely flat, no curving, intrinsic curving of space, it is about a 1 degree separation on the sky. And so you measure these angles, and when you measure the angles, you get a good sense of the total mass energy fraction of the universe compared to critical density. And what they find is that it sums up to very nearly one. It's very nearly this case, a flat universe. Now, the third thing that the astrophysicists have told us recently is about vacuum energy or the dark energy of the universe. So supernova act like standard candles in the universe. They all burn with the same brightness from some far distance. You can measure the distance for one technique and look at the brightness, and you can plot it on a graph that has superimposed on it calculations that theoretical cosmologists do that say this is what the brightness versus the distance should be if the universe were completely flat, but all of the energy density of the universe is in matter. And if all the energy density is in matter, but it's not flat, then it looks like that. And if it's flat, meaning the omega m plus omega lambda sums to one, then but more of it is in the dark energy, then it has even a different profile. And you look at that on the sky, and it turns out that it seems to be indicating that there is a dark energy component of the universe, or a cosmological component of the universe. This was I think it was dubbed by some magazine as the find of the century or something in cosmology and astrophysics, that the energy density of the universe is mostly filled with vacuum energy. And this plot here combines those three different ways of determining what the composition of the universe is in one graph. Omega lambda, which is the cosmological constant, versus omega matter. This is the flat universe. And you see that the clusters, this is the simulation of how clusters come together and form superstructures and in the sky. This is the cosmic microwave background radiation. And I told you that it was consistent with 1 degree separation on bright spots. And therefore, it lies very closely to this flat line. And then, of course, supernova is very sensitive to the dark energy of the universe. And all three intersect at one region. And that one region today is a region that is characterized by about 72% of all of the density of the universe is in this dark energy. Only 4.5% are in things like us. And then 23% is in the dark matter. Okay, so that's the story from the astrophysicists. So this is a very interdisciplinary field. The astrophysicists have told this to us somewhat independently of our particle physics initiative. Now, this leads us to the conclusion that cosmology appears to require the existence of dark matter, a special type of matter dissimilar to our own. And these were all rather indirect inferences from early universe cosmology, of course. And so the example is, a question that you would have is, well, these were indirect, and wow, I'm looking way off into the past with supernova. I'm looking with Big Bang nucleosynthesis. These are sort of esoteric, subtle things. Is it really that solid? Is there something I can see directly through experiment today that there is dark matter? So right now, can I see through experiment that there is dark matter? And the answer is yes. It's still not completely direct. You're not going to hold a dark matter particle in your hand and say, I got you. You're the dark matter particle. But there is a rather direct gravity experiment test, a very famous one, and it's the galaxy rotation profiles. So you might have seen this before. If you look at galaxies long ways away, and you track the velocity of different parts of the galaxy. So as you go from the center of the galaxy out to the far distant reaches of radius of the galaxy, you can see what the velocity profile is at these different points. And just from simple Newtonian mechanics that your students learn in your AP courses, and in the earlier courses actually, you find that the velocity needs to be, of these particles rotating around the sphere, needs to be Newton's constant times the mass that's contained within the radius divided by the radius at the point that you're looking at. And so therefore, the velocity should decrease like 1 over the square root of r if the mass is uniform, and if you're at a point far that encompasses almost all the mass of the galaxy. But it doesn't work out that way. Instead, it's flat. The rotation curve velocity is flat going out to very long distances. The distance of a galaxy is, even a big galaxy is in the 10 kiloparsec, 15 kiloparsec region, and there's some outliers out there in 20 kiloparsecs. And all the way out there, it's flat. This is a very strong indication that there is a new form of matter that's forming a halo in the galaxy that is not coalescing the same way as baryonic matter, like normal atoms, hydrogen and helium, so on, but a different kind of matter that is in this, that's going on in this galaxy. And they usually call it the dark matter halo of the galaxy. And every galaxy has a halo. Now, you say, well, is that good enough for you? I hope that's good enough for you. But if it's not, there's even a better illustration recently. This is actually, I think, quite recent. The so-called bullet cluster, galaxy clusters. You have several galaxy clusters, two of them, that are separated, and they're coming at each other. And now you ask yourself, what would happen if there was lots of dark matter that was surrounding ordinary matter in one galaxy cluster, and then lots of dark matter surrounding ordinary matter in another galaxy cluster? As they went through each other, what would happen? Well, the dark matter doesn't interact very much. Part of the reason why it's called dark is that it's not interacting. But the gas is. The gas does interact much better. And so you'll find a sort of funny, different distribution of the baryonic matter after a collision between these two clusters compared to the dark matter distribution. And the folks at Stanford made a simulation of this, and I want to see if this is actually a dynamical simulation, so I have to see if this can work on the screen. If I click, does it work? Okay. So watch it. The last frame is what they see today. This is inference of what happened in the past. And the blue is dark matter, and the red is gas. And that's what they see today. And now they're twisting it around to give you a three-dimensional view of what it looked like. So the inferred dark matter is through lensing effects in the early universe. And the hot gas is from electromagnetic radiation that you get out and you can see it. And this is and then in the future, this is what's going to happen. It's going to, you know, keep on going, these two clusters. The gas will sort of trail behind. The dark matter was just not affected very much by the collision. So this was a really strong indication that there is a large component of dark matter that's part of the galaxies and part of galaxy clusters. And it's a dark matter that exists at all scales. It exists at the scale of our galaxy and exists on the scale of very large clusters of galaxies, like is demonstrated in this bullet cluster. Okay, so I thought that was a great animation. They put a lot of time into that, I'm sure. All right, so now, what is a dark matter? I think it's really important to emphasize that we have experimental evidence which is compelling that there's something out there that we don't know and we don't understand. It's absolutely compelling. And there, you know, some people like to say, oh, there's not that many mysteries in science anymore. And so there's lots of mysteries in science, and this is one of them. And the person that figures out what the dark matter is, and it's experimentally confirmed what the dark matter is, will be just as famous as the person that focused those neutrino beams. Okay, if you were able to control the it's a little competition between speakers here. So there's many ideas of what the dark matter can be. I have just a tiny subset of those many ideas. The lightest supersymmetric particle is number one, because that's the one I like the most, and that's the one I'm going to talk about a little bit more. But there's also the lightest Kaluza-Klein excitation of the extra dimensions. So momentum conservation tells you that if some particle has momentum in extra dimensions, it can't just suddenly get rid of that extra momentum in that direction, and so it needs to be stable. It's Kaluza-Klein excitation. Techniberion, singlet fermions, gravitinos, I will talk a little bit about that, actually. The first and second I will talk about a little bit, and this gravitinos, which is a supersymmetric partner of the graviton. The graviton is the object that transmits gravity force from a particle physics perspective. We think of it as an exchange of a graviton, very similar to electromagnetism exchanges photon. We think of a graviton. There's a superpartner to the graviton, which is called the gravitino, and that actually can make a very good dark matter candidate as well. Another excellent dark matter candidate is the axion fields, which I won't get into at all, and it acts quite differently than the things that I'll talk about today, but it is a good dark matter candidate as well. All right, particle interpretation. Particle candidates must be stable. If you're going to be the dark matter, you can't die. You got to stay. You got to stay in existence, and you got to stay in existence for a long time. The universe has been around for a long time. The dark matter and all these simulations that I talked about that were consistent with dark matter, the dark matter had to be there from the beginning, and it has to stay there today. And this usually means that the lightest particle, or this dark matter particle, possesses a quantum number or some immutable quality about it. A schoolyard example, this is somewhat of a tortured analogy, but I will try it. But a schoolyard example is if you're a teacher, which I think some of you are, you can give an apple to a boy in the class and say, take this apple, and when you get within 5 feet of another boy who's shorter than you, give it to him. And in the schoolyard when you go out to recess. Now, hopefully they will all follow directions, but I understand that doesn't always happen. But if they did, every recess would end in the exact same final state. There would be one boy in the class who has the apple in his hand. Now, exactly what happened, and who gave the apple to who, and so on. Every event, every recess is different, But in the end, it's going to be that one kid who holds the apple, and he'll be holding it for the rest of the recess, forevermore. And that's similar to how dark matter particles in supersymmetry and some of these other ideas work, is you can produce something which has some immutable quality, which in supersymmetry is called R parity, some quantum number, and then it can decay down to lighter particles. So the analogy is the shorter boy. R parity is sort of like the boyness, immutable quality. And it goes down to shorter to lighter and lighter mass until it ends up in this one mass. So all events will have different cascades and so on, but it'll end up with a particle sitting there stable at the end. Now, what happens in these particles? So in the early universe, you have many, many particles in the there, including the dark matter particles. So here in this box is an early time in the universe with a high temperature, lots of dark matter particles floating around. And when they get within a certain distance of each other, they're somewhat close in phase space to each other, these dark matter pairs can interact, and they can annihilate, and they can stay in equilibrium with other particles in the universe. And you can track them with very simple equilibrium dynamics. And so there's nothing special here. The dark matter particles don't act differently than sort of anything else. But the universe is cooling and expanding. And as it cools and expands, then there comes a point in the history of the universe that the particles, the dark matter particles, can no longer find each other to interact. So when these two particles interact, they annihilate each other and they go into ordinary things like photons or fermions or electrons or something. But when they get separated like this, they freeze out, they can't find each other, and they float around forever in the universe. And this is what we think we're in the stage today at. We're in the stage where dark matter particles have frozen out, they're floating around in the universe, and are given all the data that we know, we think that we will probably have about one per hand size in this room. Maybe a little bit more, depending on the mass of it. So it's about that frequency. So I don't know, there's about one per hand size. And technically, this is what the graphs look like when people do the computations. A famous textbook, Colburn-Turner, Early Universe, shows this. This is the number density of dark matter particles, and they are falling rapidly with temperature, exponentially with temperature when the temperature gets below the mass. But at some point, they can't find each other anymore to annihilate. The reason why they're falling is sort of because they're annihilating and things. They can't find it, and they freeze out. And so their particle density stays the same forevermore. And what is so interesting to us from the LHC point of view is that there's a conspiracy of scales that is frightening, is eerie almost, is a bunch of astrophysics stuff comes together, and the early universe and equilibrium dynamics and particle number species and all that comes together and gives you some number that's about the W mass. This is the ordinary particle mass that helps set the scale of what the dark matter density is for some weakly interacting particle. And so some astrophysics number compared to some particle physics number, in order to get one, the particle physics number should be about MW. Well, that's easy. Just have some particles that are about the MW mass. And this is what gives rise to this tantalizing accident of scales and gave rise to the acronym WIMP, which is a weakly interacting massive particle. And that's what most people think the dark matter is today, is a weakly interacting massive particle. All right, so the very simplest example of dark matter in particle physics. If you find a simpler example, tell me. It's, I have a new particle. You name it anything you want. It's just a real scalar field. And I give it a quantum number, a Z2 quantum number. A Z2 charge is nothing more than calling something odd or even. And if it's odd, then it means that it can only decay into other things that are odd. If it's even, it can decay into two things that are odd and still be even. And of course, even can decay into evens. But if it's odd, it can only decay into things that are odd. And so if this particle is the lightest odd state, then it's finished, and it will be the dark, it will float around forever and never decay. That is that immutable quantum number that I was telling you about earlier. So the invariant interactions, it can be in equilibrium with ordinary fermions by having these two odd particles annihilating into two even particles. That's okay to do. But you can't decay one odd particle into two even. But you can have two odd particles go into one even particle through annihilations as well. Or decay an even particle into two odd particles. Okay, so that's a lot. I'm saying a lot of odds and evens, but the basic point is, if it's odd, it's stable, and this is the simplest case that you can think of, I believe, for dark matter particles. The most celebrated example of dark matter, I think, must be supersymmetry in the lightest supersymmetric particle. In this case, every particle of the standard model, electron, photon, muon, etc., everyone has a superpartner. It's separated in spin by a half unit. So a spin 1/2 fermion can have a spin 0 superpartner. Why supersymmetry? And this was alluded to in the previous talk, and so I won't say much about it. But what it does is it cures our theory of quantum instabilities from the Higgs boson. And so you combine the quantum corrections from ordinary fermions with its superpartner, and you get cancellations by symmetries, supersymmetry, and you get a very well-behaved answer out at the end of the calculation compared to if you didn't have supersymmetry. So this lightest supersymmetric particle, it has a special quality to it. It's R parity charged odd in a very similar way that this odd particle of the previous slide had. And R parity is a Z2, can be thought of as a Z2 symmetry, just like I mentioned. And I produce a superpartner of a gluino, for example, at the collider. So I annihilate two protons, and I produce two gluinos. And on one side of the detector, this gluino immediately decays into an ordinary particle and a superpartner of a quark. And then that immediately decays into various things, just like the schoolyard children giving the apple to the next person down the line, all the way till you get the lightest particle. And then it stops. This decay chain stops. This cannot decay into anything lighter. It's stable. It's fixed forever. And that, this is something that happens in the collider. And of course, if it's stable, you say, well, this might be a really good dark matter candidate if it's stable. And indeed, when you go through the computations, you find that it is an exceptionally good dark matter candidate. And there's nearly an infinite number of calculations along these lines that are done in the literature to show it. Okay, so here is what dark matter will look like at the LHC. This is a Feynman, sort of like a Feynman diagram look of it. Protons go into gluinos, they decay through this long chain, and there's the dark matter particle. And that dark matter particle doesn't interact with anything. It goes, flies through the detector, and then what the experimentalists see is they see a bunch of stuff on one side and nothing on the other side. They say, oh, that violates everything I know about energy momentum conservation. Therefore, there should have been some particle that doesn't interact that's going out the other side. And that particle is the dark matter. Now, what does that look like at the collider? Oh, here's another example. This is just the same kind of diagram. You can find them, lots of them on the web, these diagrams. Oh, before I show you what it looks like at the collider, I should say that in the Klutze-Klein theories that related to what Raman Sundaram was telling us about, there's a very similar decay chain pattern that can go through Klutze-Klein excitations of particles. And they go all the way down to the lightest one, and then it stops. And that's the stable one. In this case, it is the superpartner of the photon. And these people, Machov and Schmaltz, a few years ago, wrote a paper saying this looks to an experimentalist just like supersymmetry. And it can mimic supersymmetry. And this can be the dark matter of the universe. So it's a very interesting thing. Now, how do you infer dark matter at the collider? This is an example from Japan, University of Tokyo group, where they were looking at, this is missing energy signatures of supersymmetry at the collider. And there are many things that can produce missing energy at a collider. There's a W boson, which can decay into neutrino plus lepton, and that neutrino escapes all detection. So that creates some missing energy. And there's some QCD events and PT bar events. So all this shaded region is normal stuff that you would expect to see missing energy at the accelerator, at the collider. But then, if on top of that you had supersymmetry production, you would get an extra extended reach of this missing energy. This axis is missing energy as determined by the experimentalist, and this is the total number of events. And you see that it extends out here, and this would not match any computation that they did, and so they would say this is an inference of some missing particles that were produced at the collider. Now, you say, okay, I've discovered the dark matter. Something was stable, it's not neutrinos, I'm done. Of course, can't be that fast because there's some interrelated issues. The detector is only 20 meters wide. And in one nanosecond, I guess you go about that far. A particle going the speed of light will go about that far in one nanosecond. So in 20 meters, that means that the particle only had to be stable to 50 nanoseconds or something. That is, of course, very small amount of time that it needs to be stable compared to the lifetime of the universe. Lifetime of the universe, 13 billion years. So how can we say that something that was shown at the LHC is a dark matter of the universe if we only know that it survives 50 nanoseconds or so? Well, there are ways to do that. As Mark Kamienkowski at Caltech told me once, he said, look, if it's stable on the time scale of the detector, it is the dark matter, and I don't care what you say. And I said, well, I want a little bit more than that. And so, and of course, the community wants more than that. He's a very good physicist, by the way, and he understands this. And so you want confirming evidence. And so this is how this interrelated disciplines of astrophysics and particle physics come together. Is you say, all right, I found at the collider missing energy signatures and something that looked like supersymmetry. How can I confirm this? Well, if they're floating around in space, then they can still, every once in a while, annihilate. So earlier, I should have raised my right arm just a little bit, and they can interact every once in a while. And when they're in the galactic halo, they do get together a little bit more, and then they can annihilate into quarks, or they can annihilate into leptons, or into photons. There's all sorts of things that these dark matter particles floating out in space can annihilate to. So sometimes they find each other, and sometimes they annihilate, and can we get confirming evidence for this dark matter through astrophysics experiments? Very soon, GLAST will blow up, but I sure hope it doesn't blow up. It takes off. I don't know what they call it in rocketry. Blast off, there you go. Okay, yeah. It will blast off on this Delta II rocket. And what it's looking for, you can see this photon coming in. Photon comes in, hits the detector, creates a cascade, E plus, E minus, and they can get really good directional information and energy information of photons that came from the annihilation of dark matter. And this will launch within days, I think. It was scheduled a month ago. It was scheduled to take off today. So I put the slide in, but now it's not going off today. Earth-based direct detection. So there's many experiments across the world that look for direct detection of dark matter. If you have some nucleus, the WIMP, or the supersymmetric lightest partner, or whatever your dark matter particle is, can come in and can interact with it, can sort of bounce off this nucleus. Of course, there's some backgrounds to this. There can be some photons and electrons and so on that can scatter off the electrons, which can create some similar signatures at times. So you want to shield some of these things. You want to shield really well from background. And of course, neutrons can also bounce off. And so it's a very subtle experiment to be able to try to determine if you see WIMP scatterings of these floating around WIMPs into your detectors compared to background. So the CDMS experiment is a really good one for that. And recently, there's been an announcement, actually from April 2008, so just this last month, an announcement from this DAMA group that they might have found the presence of dark matter. And so DAMA is a sodium iodide experiment in Italy, and they look for seasonal effects. And actually, the next slide is a better one for this. So as you're going around the sun, you're going a different velocity with respect to the sort of the galactic frame of the dark matter. And that can create a different flux of dark matter particles that your detector is plowing through. So you have all these dark matter particles that are about, you know, this far apart throughout the land, and you come through and you sweep through at different velocities depending on the time of year. As you sweep through at different velocities, you'll get a different event rate. And so they said, well, let's try to take advantage of that. Let's see if we see a different event rate going through of scattering. And they do. And the event rate is tantalizing because it follows just the pattern that you would expect, of almost just the pattern that you would expect out of some annual modulation of a dark matter profile. This is controversial because it's really hard to mesh with non-signals from other experiments. It's also controversial among experimentalists because it doesn't really simulate the group cannot really simulate exactly what the event rate should be, even for the background. So when you don't have full control over things, it's hard to know what's happening. But I think at a minimum, everybody agrees now this is extremely interesting. And this is consistent with a low mass scale dark matter particle. And a low mass scale dark matter particle is something that interacts with nuclei, is something you could see at the LHC in principle. So lastly, I'll go through this pretty quickly. Gamma is not the only anomaly in an experiment. Previous photon and positron experiments also have challenges in trying to have purely astrophysical explanations for what they see. There's a new supersymmetry idea by Buchmüller et al. That I think is great. It's a heavy gravitino dark matter particle that can decay with a very long lifetime. So this is a little bit outside of the theme of stable quantum number, but it can decay with an extremely long lifetime into a Z boson, a neutrino, and W bosons, an electron. And why would you want to do that? You probably wouldn't have thought to do that if it weren't for the data that exists. And the data that exists, most importantly, is an anomaly of the heat collaboration of antiproton flux compared to the all-electron flux, they call it, antiprotons plus electrons. And this ratio should go down smoothly like this. That's what astrophysicists would have told you before the experiment happened. But after the experiment happened, they found this, sort of a leveling off. Of course, the error bars are big. But it's tantalizing, right? It's if you draw lines with your model, everything looks better, but it's tantalizing. And so they think that this might be an explanation for that, and there's some new data from other experiments that are coming out that might be able to confirm or deny it. And the important decays for collider, so this has direct collider consequences. We will find this sort of immediately at colliders before real confirming astrophysics evidence will come, by virtue of superpartner decays, like an electron superpartner decays into an electron and a gravitino at the collider. So you produce this electron, decays into that gravitino, and then that gravitino makes this same decay has the potential of making the same sort of decays astrophysically, but at the but it can't within the detector lifetime, and so it shows up as missing energy in the detector. So you see everything consistent with a gravitino and missing energy at the LHC, and that's consistent with the astrophysicists' work with the positron excess in that experiment. Okay. So I won't talk about this unless you have some questions, but the sleptons traversing the detector. Oh, I really should spend 1 minute on this. Okay, sorry. This will only take, I'm cutting into my question time. So I thought I heard somebody ask, what about sleptons going slowly in the detector? And there you go. I thought I heard it, so I was gonna stop, but then I was like. So the sleptons on that previous slide that I showed you, they also decay slowly, but not, it's not the lifetime of the universe, but it takes a long time before they decay. So what happens is you have this very heavy charged particle that just slowly wanders through the detector. You make it, and it's really heavy and massive, and it slowly wanders all the way to the end of the detector. Okay, well, how are you going to find that? And the way you find it is by differentiation with velocity. All the muons that you make at the collider, which look a lot like these sleptons in every way, except that the sleptons are so slow. And this is velocity in units of the speed of light. The sleptons that are produced have this large distribution of very slow velocities compared to the muons that are created, which are almost always very close to the speed of light. And so experimentalists have found ways of measuring the time of flight of these charged particles and can do excellent rejection of standard model compared to these dark matter ideas, to the slepton, stable slepton idea, by looking at the slowness. This is 1 over the velocity. So the slowness you pick out, and you say, there's nothing like that in the standard model. It's only the new physics that does that. And you immediately have a signal and a signature of this idea that Buchmüller et al. Had for dark matter. And this can be done within 1 year. Okay, so I'm finishing up with the last slide is the detector. And this, and there's this guy down here, right? That's halfway through the construction of it. And it's a staggering sight to see if you've ever seen it, and CERN's got great pictures of it on the web, and I just pulled down one of them. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Excellent connection. Okay. Begin with ladies first.
Yeah, I wonder if I might ask 2 questions. One of the first, the simulation of the formation of the galaxies, it said that it was the size of the universe was 150 billion light years. So I'm assuming that that is projecting into the future. So
no.
No?
Well, it's just if you take, so roughly speaking, if you take the total amount of time the universe has been in existence and multiply by c.
So oh.
Roughly.
Okay.
The size.
Okay. All right. So then my next question is why would the dark matter particles annihilate?
Why would they annihilate?
Yeah.
Well, so they're not allowed to decay, but they are able to annihilate because the quantum numbers don't forbid it. And so it's just like the children in your classroom. If it's not expressly forbidden, it will happen. And so these particles, when they get near each other, they'll interact, and it's not forbidden by any quantum numbers to interact and annihilate into ordinary particles. And there's some quantum mechanical probability for that happening. And it's probabilistic, of course. So sometimes when they get close to each other, they don't interact, but sometimes they do, and that's allowed.
I have a question about the gravitinos that you mentioned. The gravitinos, they have mass, as you mentioned.
Yes.
And they are still the exchange particle for gravitation.
they don't exchange, because they're massive, the gravitinos don't, are not the intermediaries of gravitational interactions.
They are not?
The gravitons are, the spin two gravitons, those are massless. And so they had a long distance propagation and ability to interact with gravitationally.
I mean, that was my question. If there are also the exchange particle for gravitation, so we should see that very small distances, for example, between particles in solid and nucleus, we should have a higher gravitational force than at large distance.
Not with these. These masses are they don't exchange carriers for gravity interaction. What does happen though is if they are very, very light, gravitinos are very, very light, then they can have stronger and stronger interactions with matter. And you can actually produce gravitinos directly through the experimental, I didn't talk about this, but you can directly produce them through annihilations. And you don't have to wait for it to be a decay product of something else. But it won't show up as a fifth force experiment or some kind of long range interaction or anything like that. Not the gravitino won't.
Why would the WIMP wind be prevailing? Coming from the WIMP wind, this experiment, they detected different velocities based on the time of the year. Why would that be from a prevailing direction?
Oh, because their history of WIMPs is different than the history of dark matter, so of normal matter. So our Earth and our Sun and everything, its history was to sort of coalesce. There's some angular momentum, and everything's going around the galaxy at some pace, and the Earth is going around. But the dark matter didn't have that history. It had a sort of a violent, different history when it constructed. And so there's no sort of wind that goes with it, so to speak. And in any event, it goes, here's the center of the galaxy, here's us in the solar system, and we're going around it like this. So in any case, you will see some seasonal variation depending upon where you're at in the cycle of the year.
Right here. The last I heard was that in October, CERN would be up to about 10 TeV. Is there an update on the latest turn-on time for CERN?
Yes. CERN is, right now it's undergoing the cooling down process and finishing that. And in the fall, they're going to do a run of 5 TeV beams on 5 TeV beams. And there, the experimentalists, the big desire among the experimentalists is to understand how the accelerator works well, make sure no problems happen, try to rediscover the standard model in this new collider, which is the first order of business, because you can't discover new things unless you understand the old things really well. And so that's really the main goals of the first run in the fall. And then it will shut down for the winter, and there'll be some tunes and adjustments and things. And then the full 7 TeV on 7 TeV beam will start in the spring. And that's the moment that good data is coming that should be understandable and be able to find new physics and find these new things. In that last slide that I showed you, by the end of next year, they will know if that last slide is right. It's really an extraordinary time in our field. And they'll know a lot of things by the end of next year if things work the way they expect.
One of your slides there that was showing proof or evidence of dark matter, I guess you called it gravitational rotation, showed that and it was basically Newton's law. If you had a point object, the speed rotating around would be proportional to 1 over r squared. Yet that's not what we observe. We observe 1 over r, and hence the proof that there's something else out there. But is that proof of dark matter, or is that proof of just other matter, just regular matter? Because you could you could have a distribution of regular baryons and get that same result.
That's right. So years ago, there was a competing community of people who didn't like WIMPs, the weakly interacting massive particles, and so they made their own acronym, MACHOs, which was massive compact halo objects. And that's sort of like non-luminous objects in the universe. So in order for hydrogen to burn in a sun, you know, to make a little, your mass has to be something like at least 7% of a sun's mass. And so if you postulated that there was lots of things that just formed, like super planets or brown dwarfs or something, that formed that had smaller mass than 7% of the sun, then that could be the dark matter. It could just float out there and somehow it arranged itself and it was the dark matter. But it doesn't really quite work out, because there's been two things that really cause problems with that. One thing is lensing experiments, where you look at the Large Magellanic Cloud and you want to see, is there anything in between the light and here that would distort the signal like some massive sort of sub-sun object. And there's not enough evidence for that to be the dark matter. And the other is a self-consistency story, is that the baryonic matter has to be only 4% of the universe. We know there has to be dark matter. And so Occam's razor, in some respects, in this case, tells us the new stuff is better than to try to make epicycles with the old stuff.
Okay. The distribution of dark matter in a given galaxy, you mentioned, if I understand it correctly, is it in the halo or is it throughout? Does it have a specific distribution? And secondly, when you showed the collision of the two galaxies, you showed that the dark matter was separated from ordinary matter because it didn't collide or something. Well, the dark matter is also interacting gravitationally. So why is the collision different for ordinary matter versus dark matter? Why was that separation shown, the astronomical observation that you showed?
Because gas acts, I'll answer the second question first and then the first question. Gas acts different, more strongly than gravitationally, because you can radiate photons and slow things down by that manner. Whereas gravitationally, you can't do that. So that's the answer to the second question. The first question is that there's been a long history of what people thought the gravitational profile is of the galaxies. So in the old days, they thought it was just this big ball, isothermal sphere of dark matter that had some hardcore radius. So it was sort of uniform distribution up to a few kiloparsecs, and then it sort of died down like 1 over r squared, a little bit higher than 1 over r squared, in a big ball. But more and more simulations and more experiment and so on has sort of squashed that ball. And so it's done two things. It sort of squashed that ball, and there's more uncertainty as to what the dark matter distribution really looks like near the core of the galaxy. And so there's parameterizations that are sort of famous in the field for the dark matter distribution, and you can more or less think of it as sort of halfway between sort of a sphere and a pancake, and sort of the sphere squashed. And that's the history of the dark matter.
Before we
Well, I think before the next talk, I would like to thank James, not just for that talk, but also for James. Thank you. Because he also really coordinated putting together this conference, in addition to helping organize the program. And I think we should also, at some point, thank Jocelyn and the the wonderful staff here, because they've really worked very hard to make this happen. And as always, before we start with the last discussion of Los Combros, I wanted to come back to the question of the next conference. And get some input from you. We haven't decided. We will decide, but you recall that last year we talked in the same setting about LHC or climate and got some feedback from you about. So the same thing now. There's sort of, given our program for the next year, there are two natural candidates. Both are programs that will be running next spring. One of them, perhaps the most likely, would be another strings program. Again, a discussion of string theory, where it's at, what are its prospects, et cetera, et cetera. We're having a long strings program running from February through June. And however, there's no conference associated with that program. So normally we attach this conference to a scientific conference. In this case, Monday morning, the LHC conference begins for a week. In the case of the strings program, for a variety of reasons, there will be no strings conference. Trouble is, if you hold a strings conference, 500 people show up, and that's a lot. But instead, but that doesn't make it impossible for us to hold one of these teachers' conferences. We have a lot of string theorists around. So we're thinking of that. That's one possibility. The advantage of no conferences, we have a lot of flexibility as to when we time that, and I'd also like some feedback about timing. There was some question when we chose this timing for this conference. Some people said, well, it's too late, there are exams and nobody will come, but it turned out to be okay. So that's one thing. The other possibility is we are having a program which is called Quantum Control. It's really a program on the growing control of atoms and a variety of techniques, atomic physics, optical physics, laser physics. We haven't discussed it yet with the coordinators of that program, but they are having a conference. Their conference is right about now, a year from now, at the end of May, and we could attach a teachers' conference to that atomic conference, maybe. So what I really would like is, strong feelings one way or the other, or some reaction about, of course, many of you do come back about a strings conference. We've done that before, but things evolve. String theory will go on forever. and something newer, which would be atomic physics, and timing. Is this a good time? It's a great time. Well, there are some people, but there are other conflicts. Well, it depends what kind of atomic physics. Atomic physics is a very broad field. This is really more focused on control, how you control atomic beams, how you control atoms with lasers. Yes, anyone? Any other reactions? This is not nanoscience. That's not the focus of this particular group, though. If I know what you're thinking of. Atomic. So I get the feeling that, especially among those who've been here before, you're tired of hearing about string theory. Yeah? That'd be neat. Okay. And timing this time of the year in the end of May is good? Well, you're all here, of course. That's like asking who's not here, right? Do you have colleagues for whom this is a bad time because you're getting close to final exams or the end of the term? Or a week later? Later is easier? No. What about the end of May compared to March or April? Well, everybody has different spring breaks, isn't it? No, we wouldn't go into June. We have also graduations here. Okay, thank you. So now we're moving to our now annual